can still be saved," she repeated insistently. "And he can still be saved, too."
"Who do you want to save him from?" asked Homer, jerking his head up.
She looked at him, mistrustfully. Did the old man really still not understand, after she had tried so hard?
"From the man in the mirror."
"Is this place taken?"
Sasha started and stopped, absent-mindedly prodding at her mushroom casserole with her fork. The green-eyed musician was standing beside her with a tray in his hands. The old man had gone off somewhere for a moment, and his place was empty.
"Yes.
A solution can always be found."
He put down his tray, jerked across a free stool from the next table and sat down on Sasha's left before she could protest.
"Just remember, I didn't invite you,"
she warned him.
"Well, Grandad scold you then?"
the musician asked with a knowing wink.
"Allow me to introduce myself, Leonid."
"He's not my granddad,"
said Sasha, feeling the blood rush to her cheeks.
"So, that's the way it is,"
asked Leonid, stuffing his mouth as full as he could and arching up one eyebrow.
"You're brazen,"
she remarked.
"I'm assertive,"
he said, raising his fork in the air didactically.
"You're too sure of yourself,"
Sasha said with a smile.
"I believe in people in general, and myself in particular,"
he mumbled indistinctly as he chewed. The old man came back, stood behind the intruder, and pulled a sour face, but sat down on his own stool anyway.
"Aren't you feeling a bit crowded, Sasha?"
he inquired peevishly, looking straight past the musician.
"Sasha!"
the musician repeated triumphantly, glancing up from his bowl.
"Pleased to meet you. Let me remind you that my name's Leonid."
"Nikolai Ivanovich,"
Homer introduced himself, squinting at the young man sullenly.
"What was that melody you were playing today? It sounded familiar."
"That's not surprising. This is the third day I've been playing it here,"
the young man replied.
"Actually, it's my own composition."
"Yours?"
said Sasha, putting down her knife and fork.
"What's it called?"
"It's not called anything," Leonid said with a shrug. "I hadn't really thought about a title for it. How can I describe it in letters? And what for, anyway?"
"It's very beautiful,"
the girl admitted.
"Really incredibly beautiful."
"Then I can name it in your honor,"
the quick-witted musician replied.
"You're worthy of it."
"No, don't,"
she said and shook her head.
"Leave it as it is, without any name. There's a point to that."
"And there's a definite point in dedicating it to you, too."
He tried to laugh, but choked and started coughing.
"Well, are you ready?"
The old man picked up Sasha's tray and stood up.
"It's time. Excuse us, please, young man."
"That's all right. I finished eating already. May I see the young lady on her way?"
"We're leaving,"
Homer said abruptly.
"Great. So am I. Going to Dobrynin."
The musician put on an innocent air.
"Are you by any chance going my way?"
"Yes, we are,"
said Sasha, surprising even herself. She tried not to look in Homer's direction, and her gaze kept slipping across to Leonid. There was something light and easy about him, a good-humored affability, like a little boy fencing with a twig. He struck with light jabs that didn't hurt and were impossible to feel angry about. And he presented his hints to Sasha so affectedly and amusingly that she never even thought of taking them seriously. And what was wrong with him liking her? And then, she had fallen in love with his music long before she met him, and the temptation of taking this magic with her on her journey was simply too great. It was all down to the music, no doubt about that, like the Pied Piper of Hamelin. This damned youth enticed innocent souls with that sleek flute of his and used his gift to debauch all the girls he could get his hands on. Now he was trying to get his hands on Alexandra, and Homer didn't know what to do about it. The old man found it hard to swallow Leonid's brash jokes, and before long they started sticking in his throat. And Homer was also annoyed by how quickly the musician had managed to reach an agreement with the obstinate Hansa boss for the three of them to be allowed to walk the stretch of the Circle Line to Dobrynin, even without any documents. The musician had walked into the spacious offices of the station commandant, a bald, aging dandy with a moustache like a cockroach's whiskers, with his heavy flute case full of cartridges, and come back out smiling, with his load lightened. Homer had to admit that Leonid's diplomatic abilities had come in handy at just the right moment for them. The motor trolley on which they had arrived at Pavelets had disappeared from the parking area at the same time as Hunter disappeared, and going the long way round could have taken them up to a week.
But what provoked the old man's suspicions most of all was the flippant way the minstrel had uprooted himself from a profitable station and parted with all his savings just so that he could set off into the tunnels after home as Sasha. In different circumstances, this flippancy would have been a sign of being in love, but in this case, the old man could see nothing but frivolous intentions and the habit of rapid conquests. Yes, little by little, Homer was turning into a crotchety chaperone. But he had good reasons to be on his guard and grounds for jealousy. The last thing he needed now was for the muse who had been miraculously restored to him to run off with a wandering minstrel. With an absolutely superfluous character who had no place waiting for him in the novel, but had simply dragged in his own stool and churlishly seated himself right smack in the middle of it.
Is there really no one left anywhere on earth?
The trio was striding towards Dobrynin, accompanied by three guards. The correct use of cartridges could make even the boldest dreams come true. The girl, who had just given the others a gushing account of her expedition to the surface, broke off and turned sad. Homer and the musician exchanged glances. Who would be first to dash in and console her?
Is there life beyond the Moscow orbital highway? The old man snorted. Does the new generation wonder about that?
Of course it does, Leonid declared confidently. The trouble is that no one else survived. There's simply no contact.
Well, I, for instance, have heard that somewhere beyond Taganka Station there's a secret passage that leads to a certain curious tunnel, said the old man. A normal enough-looking tunnel, 6 meters in diameter, only without any rails. It lies deep, 40 or even 50 meters below ground, and it runs way off to the east.
Would that be the tunnel that leads to the bunkers in the Urals?
Leonid interrupted.
And is this the story about the man who wandered into it by accident and came back with a supply of food and—
Walked for a week, with short halts. Then his provisions started to run out and he had to turn back. There was still no sign of the tunnel coming to an end.
Homer concluded scrappily, put off his folk-narrative tone.
Yes, according to the rumors, it leads to the Urals bunkers, where there could still be someone left alive.
It's not very likely,
said the musician, yawning.
And then an acquaintance of mine in Polis told me how one of the local radio operators had established contact with the crew of a tank who had battened down their hatches and withdrawn to somewhere so remote that no one ever even thought of bombing it, said the old man, ostentatiously speaking to Sasha.
Yeah, right, said Leonid, nodding. That's a well-known story, too. When they ran out of fuel, they buried the tank in the ground on a hill and laid out a whole farm around it, and for a few more years they talked to police on the radio in the evenings.
Until the radio broke down, Homer concluded irritably.
Right. And what about the submarine?
His rival drawled.
The nuclear submarine that was on a long-range mission, and when the strikes and counter-strikes began, it simply didn't have enough time to move into battle position, and when it did surface, everything had already been over for ages, so then the crew put it on permanent mooring not far from Vladivostok?
And to this day an entire village is powered by its reactor,
the old man put in.
6 months ago I met a man who claimed to be the first mate of that submarine's captain. He said he'd crossed the entire country on a bicycle all the way to Moscow. He was traveling for 3 years.
Did you talk to him in person?
Leonid asked in polite surprise.
In person? Homer snarled.
Legends had always been his hobby horse, and he simply couldn't allow this young smart aleck to get the better of him. He had one more story left in reserve, a closely guarded one. He'd been intending to tell it on a quite different occasion, not waste it in a pointless argument. But seeing Sasha laughing at this grifter's latest joke, he made up his mind.
But have you heard about polar dawns?
What dawns?
Asked the musician, turning towards him.
Oh, come on now, said the old man, restraining a smile. The far north, the Kola Peninsula, Polar Dawn City, a godforsaken place, 1,500 kilometers from Moskva and at least 1,000 to Peter. Nothing anywhere near it except Murmansk, with its navy bases, but even that's a fair distance away.
The middle of nowhere, basically,
said Leonid, encouraging him.
Far away from the big cities, the secret factories and the military bases. Far away from all the main targets. The cities that our anti-rugged shield couldn't defend were reduced to dust and ashes. The ones that had a shield
where the interceptors had time to cut in. The old man looked upwards.
You know for yourself, but there were other places that no one was aiming at, because they didn't represent any kind of threat. Polar dawns, for instance.
No one has any interest in the place now either, the musician responded.
But they should, the old man snapped, because right next to Polar Dawns was the Kola Atomic Power Station, one of the most powerful in the country. It supplied power to almost the entire north of Russia. Millions of people, hundreds of factories. I come from those parts myself, from Arkhangelsk. I know what I'm talking about. And I visited that station as a school kid on a guided tour. A genuine fortress, a state within a state. Its own little army, its own agricultural land, its own farm. They could survive autonomously, even if there was a nuclear war. It wouldn't change anything in their life. He chuckled darkly.
So what you're trying to say?
Petersburg went. Murmansk went. On Arkhangelsk, millions of people perished. All the factories, along with the cities, reduced to dust and ash. But Polar Dawn City is still there. And the Kola Atomic Power Station wasn't damaged. Nothing but snow for thousands of kilometers on every side. Expanses of snow and ice, wolves and polar bears. No contact with the center. And they have enough fuel to supply a large city for several years. But for them, even including Polar Dawns, it will last for 100 years. They'll easily make it through the winter.
It's a genuine ark, Leonid whispered. And when the flood comes to an end and the waters recede, down from the summit of Mount Ararat...
Exactly,
the old man said with a nod.
How do you know about this?
There wasn't a trace of irony or boredom left in the musician's voice now.
I used to work as a radio operator once,
Homer replied evasively.
I really wanted to find at least one person alive in my own native parts.
Will they hold out for long there in the north?
I'm sure they will. Of course, the last time I was in contact was about 2 years ago. But can you imagine what that means? Another entire century with electricity, in the warmth, with medical equipment, with computers, with electronic libraries on disks. There's no way you could know about that. There are only a couple of computers in the entire metro, and they're no more than toys. And this is the capital!
The old man laughed bitterly.
And if there are still people left somewhere, not solitary individuals, I mean, but at least villages, they've been back in the 17th century for a long time already, or maybe even the Stone Age. Wooden spiels for light, cattle, witchcraft, every third child dying at birth, abacuses and birch mark manuscripts, and apart from the two nearest farms, there's nothing else in the world. Empty land in desolation, wolves, bears, mutants. Why, the whole of modern civilization is built on electricity. When the power runs out, the stations will die, and that's it. Billions of people took centuries to construct this building, brick by brick, and it's all been reduced to dust. Start all over again. Only can we do it. But there, they have a breathing space. A whole country. You were right. It's Noah's Ark. An almost unlimited supply of energy. Oil has to be extracted and processed. Gas has to be drilled for and pumped through thousands of kilometers of pipes. Do we have to go back to steam engines then? Or even further? I'll tell you what, he said, taking Sasha by the hand. People aren't in any danger. People are as resilient as cockroaches. But civilization, that's what I'd like to preserve.
And have they got real civilization, then?
Don't you worry about that. Nuclear engineers, the technical intelligentsia, and their conditions are definitely better than ours are here. Polar Dawns has grown quite a lot in the last 20 years. They set up a transmitter with a repeating message calling all survivors, and it gives their coordinates. They say people still come crawling in, even now.
Why haven't I ever heard about this? The musician muttered.
Not many have. It's hard to pick up their wavelength here. But you try it sometime, if you got a couple of years to spare.
The old man chuckled.
The call sign is Last Harbor.
I'd have known about it, the young man said seriously, shaking his head. I collect cases like that. You really mean there wasn't any war there?
How can I put it? Wilderness on all sides. Even if there were any villages or small towns nearby, they went wild quickly enough. Sometimes the barbarians attacked, and the animals, of course, if you can call them that. But they had the arsenal to hold them off. All-round defenses, a fortified perimeter, electrified barbed wire, guard towers, a genuine fortress, I tell you. And during the first 10 years, the worst time, they put up another barrier, a log stockade. They reconnoitered everything around them, even got as far as Murmansk, 200 kilometers away. There isn't any more Murmansk, just a fused crater where it used to be. They were even planning to organize an expedition southwards to Moscow. I tried to talk them out of it. Why cut the umbilical cord? When the background radiation falls, they'll be able to bring more land under cultivation, and then... But in the meantime, there's nothing they can do here. This place is just one big graveyard. Homer sighed.
That would be amusing, if the human race that destroyed itself with the atom is saved by the atom too.
There's nothing amusing about it, said the old man, giving him a stern glance.
It's like the fire that Prometheus stole, the musician explained. The gods forbade him to give fire to humans. He wanted to drag man out of the mud, the darkness, and stagnation.
I've read it, Homer interrupted acidly. The myths and legends of ancient Greece.
A prophetic myth, Leonid remarked. The gods had good reason to be against it. They knew how it would end.
But it was fire that made man into man, Homer objected.
And you reckon that without electricity he'll turn back into an animal? The musician asked.
I reckon that without it we'll be thrown back at least 200 years, and taking into account that only 1 in 1,000 survived and everything has to be rebuilt, brought back under control and studied all over again, at least 500. And maybe we'll never recover. Why, don't you agree?
I do, Leonid replied. But is it really just a matter of electricity?
Well, what do you think it is? Homer erupted, throwing his hands up.
The musician gave him a strange, long, lingering glance and shrugged. The silence dragged on. Homer could definitely regard this outcome of their conversation as a victory for him. The girl had finally stopped devouring the impertinent rogue with her eyes and started thinking about something else. But just as they were getting very close to the station, Leonid suddenly declared,
"All right, why don't I tell you a story?"
The old man tried his best to appear exhausted, but he replied with a gracious nod.
They say that beyond Sport Station and before the ruined so-called Niki Bridge, a dead-end tunnel branches off the main one, running down at a steep angle. It ends at a metal grill with a tightly closed hermetic door behind it. They've tried to open the door several times, but never got anywhere. And any solitary travelers who set out to find it almost never come back, and their bodies are found over at the far side of the metro.
The Emerald City? Homer asked, twisting up his face. Everybody knows, Leonid carried on, taking no notice,
that the so-called Niki Bridge collapsed on the first day, and all the stations beyond it were cut off from the metro. It's usually believed that no one left on the other side of the bridge was saved, although there's absolutely no proof of that.
The Emerald City, Homer said, waving his hand impatiently.
Everybody also knows that Moscow University was built on unstable ground, which was only able to support the immense building thanks to powerful cold generators working away in its basements, freezing the swampy earth. Without them it would have slid into the river a long time ago.
A stale old cliché,
the old man put in, realizing where all this was leading.
More than 20 years have gone by, but for some reason the abandoned building is still standing there. Because it's hogwash, that's why.
Some rumors say that what lies under the university is not just a basement, but a large strategic bomb shelter that goes 10 stories down, and apart from the cold generators, it contains its own nuclear reactor, and living space and connections to the closest metro stations, and even to Metro 2.
Leonid made terrible eyes at Sasha, and she smiled.
I haven't heard anything new yet,
Homer growled contemptuously.
They say there's a genuine underground city there,
the musician continued dreamily.
A city in which the inhabitants, of course they didn't die, have devoted themselves to the collection of lost knowledge, crumb by crumb, and the service of beauty. Sparing no resources, they send out expeditions to the picture galleries, museums, and libraries that have survived, and they raise their children so that they don't lose the sense of beauty either. Peace and harmony reign there, and there are no ideologies apart from enlightenment, and no religions apart from art. There are none of those ugly old-style walls painted in two drab colors with linseed oil paint. Instead of the crudely barked commands and warning sirens, the loudspeakers broadcast Berlioz, Haydn, and Tchaikovsky, and absolutely everyone, just imagine it, can quote Dante from memory. And these people have managed to stay the same as they were. Or no, they're not the way they were in the 21st century, but like people were in ancient times. Well, you've read about that in Myths and Legends.
The musician smiled at the old man as if he was feeble-minded.
Free, bold, wise, and beautiful. Just. Noble.
I've never heard anything of the sort,
exclaimed Homer, hoping that the cunning devil wouldn't win the girl over with this.
In the metro, said Leonid, looking intently at the old man, this place is known as the Emerald City. But according to the rumors, its inhabitants prefer a different name.
And what's that? Homer erupted.
The Ark.
Drivel. Absolute drivel. The old man snorted and turned away.
Of course it's drivel,
the musician responded phlegmatically.
It's just a story.
Dobrynin had been overrun by chaos. Homer looked around, perplexed and frightened. Could he be mistaken? Could something like this be happening at one of the calmer stations of the Circle Line? It looked to him as if someone had declared war on Hansa within the last half hour. Peeping out of the parallel tunnel was a freight trolley with dead bodies piled up on it higgledy-piggledy. Military medical orderlies in aprons were dragging the bodies onto the platform and laying them out on tarpaulin sheets. One had been separated from its head, another one's face had been reduced to pulp. The intestines were tumbling out of a third. Homer covered Sasha's eyes. Leonid filled his lungs with air and turned away.
What happened?
One of the guards assigned to the threesome asked in a frightened voice.
It's our watch from the large junction with the special service line. Every last man's here, no one got away, and we don't know who did it.
The medical orderly wiped his hand on his apron.
Give me a light, will you, brother? My hands are shaking.
The special service line, a cobweb thread line that ran off behind the Pavelets radial line station connecting four lines together, circle, grey, orange and green. Homer had assumed that Hunter would choose that route, which was the shortest, although it was guarded by reinforced Hansa units. What was all this bloodshed for? Did they open fire on him first, or did they not even spot him in the gloom of the tunnel? And where was he now? Oh, God, another head. How could he do something like this? Homer remembered the shattered mirror and what Sasha had said. Could she be right after all? Was the brigadier trying to restrain himself, trying to avoid killing unnecessarily but unable to stop? And when he broke the mirror, was he really trying to strike the hideous, terrifying man that he was gradually turning into? No. What Hunter had seen in the mirror wasn't a man, but a genuine monster. That was who he had tried to crush. But he had only shattered the glass, transforming one reflection into dozens. Or, perhaps, the old man watched as the orderlies moved from the trolley to the platform, carrying the eighth man, the last. Perhaps it was the man who was still staring bleakly out of the mirror, the old Hunter. And that other was already on the outside. Chapter 14. What else?
Really? What is it that makes man human? He's been wandering the earth for more than a million years, but the magical transformation that changed the cunning and gregarious animal into something completely different, something absolutely unprecedented, happened to him only about 10,000 years ago. Just imagine. For 99% of his history, he sheltered in caves and chomped on raw meat. Without knowing how to get warm or make tools and genuine weapons, not even knowing how to talk properly. And the range of feelings he was capable of experiencing didn't really differentiate him from monkeys and wolves. Cold, fear, attachment, anxiety, gratification. How was he able, in the space of a few centuries, to learn to build and think and record his own thoughts? To alter the matter around him and invent things? Why did he feel the need to draw? And how did he discover music? How was he able to conquer the entire world and restructure it to suit his requirements? What exactly was it that was added to this animal 10,000 years ago? Fire? The fact that man was given the ability to tame light and warmth, to carry them with him to cold, uninhabited regions, to roast his prey on campfires in order to satisfy his stomach. But what did that change? Apart from allowing him to extend his domain. Rats managed to colonize the entire planet without any fire. And they remained what they were to begin with. Quick-witted, gregarious mammals. No, it can't have been fire. At least not only fire. The musician was right. Something else. But what? Language? Now there was an undeniable difference from other animals. The precise faceting of rough thoughts into the glittering diamonds of words that can become a universal currency and circulate everywhere. The ability not so much to express what is going on in your head, as to arrange it in proper sequence. The casting of unstable images, which flow like molten metal into solid forms. The clarity of mind and coolness of judgment. The ability to transmit orders and knowledge by mouth clearly and unambiguously, which leads to the ability to organize and subordinate, to assemble armies and build states. But ants manage without words, constructing genuine megalopolises on their own level, inconspicuous though it is to man and all finding their own places in supremely complicated hierarchies, conveying information and commands to each other with precision, drafting thousands of soldiers into intrepid legions with iron discipline, which clash head-on in the inaudible but remorseless wars of their tiny empires. Perhaps letters? Letters, without which the accumulation of knowledge would be impossible. Those bricks out of which the Babylonian tower of world civilization reaching for the heavens was built, without which the unbaked clay of the wisdom mastered by one generation would crack and split apart, subside and disintegrate into dust, unable to support its own weight. Without them, every successive generation would have started building the great tower again from the previous level, and spent its entire life fumbling with the ruins of the preceding wattle and daub hut before dying in its own turn without ever erecting the next level.
Letters and writing allowed man to export accumulated knowledge beyond the narrow boundaries of his own skull and so preserve it undistorted for his descendants,
relieving them of the need to rediscover what had already been discovered long ago, and allowing them to build something of their own on the firm foundation inherited from their ancestors. But it wasn't only letters, was it? If wolves could write, would their civilization be like man's? Would they have a civilization? When a wolf is sated with food, he falls into a state of blissful prostration, devoting his time to endearments and play,
until the griping in his belly drives him on again.
But when a man is sated with food, a yearning of a different kind, elusive and inexplicable, awakens within him. The same yearning that makes him gaze at the stars for hours on end, scrape ochre onto the walls of his cave, decorate the bow of his warboat with carved figures,
slave for centuries to erect stone colossi instead of reinforcing the walls of his fortress, and spend his life on honing his artistry with words instead of perfecting his mastery of the sword. The same yearning that makes a former engine driver's mate devote the remainder of his life to reading and searching, searching for something, and trying to capture it in words. Something special. The yearning that drives a dirty, impoverished crowd to listen to wandering fiddlers in an attempt to satisfy it, that makes kings welcome troubadours and patronize artists, and makes a girl who was born underground gaze for hours at a daub on a packet that once held a teabag. A vague but powerful summons that can drown out even the call of hunger, but only in a human being. Is it not this call that expands man's range of feelings beyond those accessible to other animals, giving him in addition the ability to dream, the audacity to hope, and the courage to show mercy, love, and compassion, which man often regards as his distinctive qualities, were not discovered by him? A dog is capable of loving and being compassionate. When its master is ill, it stays with him and whines. A dog can even suffer boredom and perceive the meaning of its own life in another creature. If its master is dying, it is sometimes prepared to perish simply to remain with him. But it doesn't have dreams and aspirations. So it's a yearning for beauty and the ability to appreciate it. The remarkable ability to take pleasure in combinations of colors, sequences of sounds, the angles of lines, and the elegance of verbal structures, to extract from them a sweet vibration that rings the heart and soul, that rouses any soul, whether it is bloated with fat or hard and calloused or seamed with scars, and helps it purge itself of extraneous excrescences. Perhaps. But not only that. In order to drown out the stuttering bursts of submachine gun fire and the despairing howls of naked bound human beings, other human beings played the majestic operas of Wagner at full volume. No contradiction arose. One thing merely emphasized the other. Then what else? And even if man does survive as a biological species in this present-day hell, will he preserve this fragile, almost impalpable but undoubtedly real particle of his essential being? The spark that 10,000 years ago transformed a half-starving beast with a dull gaze into a creature of a new order, into a being tormented more by hunger of the soul than hunger of the flesh. A rebellious being, fluctuating eternally between spiritual grandeur and ignominy, between an inexplicable mercy quite inappropriate for predators, and an unjustifiable cruelty unequaled even in the soulless world of insects, who erects magnificent palaces, and paints incredible canvases, rivaling the Creator in his ability to synthesize pure beauty, and invents gas chambers and hydrogen bombs in order to annihilate everything that he himself has created and economically annihilate his own fellows. Who painstakingly builds sandcastles on the beach and blithely destroys them. Did that spark transform him into a being who knows no limits in anything? An irrepressibly restless being who doesn't know how to satisfy his strange hunger, but devotes his entire life to the attempt to do it? Into man? Will this remain in him? Will this remain after him? Or will it be lost in his past? Merely a brief peek in the graph of history, leaving man to revert from this strange 1% deviation to his perennial torpidity, an habitual, customary state of stagnation, in which innumerable generations follow each other, chewing the cud,
without even raising their eyes from the ground. And the passing of 10 years, or 100, or 500,000, is equally imperceptible. What else?
Is it true? What exactly?
Leonid asked her with a smile.
About the Emerald City? About the Ark? That there is a place like that in the Metro?
Sasha asked pensively, looking down at her feet.
There are rumors,
he replied evasively.
It would be great to get in there someday,
she said slowly.
You know, when I was walking up on the surface, I felt so sad for people, so bitter that they made just one mistake, and they'll never be able to put everything back the way it used to be, and it was so good there, probably.
A mistake? No, it was an absolutely heinous crime, the musician replied seriously.
To destroy the entire world? To kill 6 billion people, is that a mistake? Even so, you and I deserve forgiveness, don't we? So does everyone else. Everyone should be given a chance to make himself over and do everything over again, to try again one more time, even if it's the last one.
She paused.
I'd like so much to see what it's really like up there. I wasn't interested before. I was simply afraid, and everything on the surface seemed ugly to me. But it turns out I just went up in the wrong place. It's so stupid. That city up there is like my life before. There's no future in it. Only memories, and they're not mine. Only ghosts, and I understood something very important while I was there, you know?
Sasha hesitated.
Hope is like blood. While it still flows through your veins, you're alive. I want to hope. But why do you want to go to the Emerald City?
The musician asked.
I want to see, to feel, what it was like to live before. You said yourself. I suppose the people there really must be very different. People who haven't forgotten yesterday and who'll definitely have a tomorrow must be quite different.
They strolled slowly round the hall of Dobrynin Station, under the watchful eyes of the sentries. Homer had left them alone with obvious reluctance, and now he had been delayed for some reason. Hunter still hadn't put in an appearance. Sasha saw hints in the marble features of Dobrynin's marble hall. The large marble-faced arches leading to the tracks alternated with small decorative blank arches. Large, small, large again, small again, like a man and a woman holding hands. A man and a woman. And she suddenly wanted to put her hand into a broad, strong male palm, too, to shelter in it, if only for a short while.
You can build a new life here, too,
Leonid told the girl, winking at her.
You don't necessarily have to go somewhere and search for something. It can be enough just to look around. And what will I see? Me,
he said, lowering his eyes in theatrical modesty.
I've already seen you, and heard you,
said Sasha, returning his smile at last.
I like what I heard, like everyone else. Don't you need your cartridges at all? You gave away so many to get them to let us through here.
I only need enough for my food, and I always have enough. It's stupid to play for money.
Then what do you play for?
For the music, he laughed.
For the people.
No, that's not right either. For what the music does to the people.
And what does it do to them?
Well, actually, anything at all, said Leonid, turning serious again.
I have music that will make people love, and music that will make them weep. And the music you were playing the last time?
Sasha looked at him suspiciously.
The music without a name? What does that make people do?
This one? He asked and whistled the introduction.
It doesn't make them do anything. It just takes away pain.
Hey, mate!
Homer closed the exercise book and squirmed on the uncomfortable wooden bench. The duty orderly was ensconced behind a little counter with a surface that was almost completely taken up by 3 old black telephones without buttons or discs. The little red light on one of the phones was winking amicably.
Andrei Andreevich is free now. He's got 2 minutes for you from the moment you walk in. Don't mumble. Get straight to the point.
The duty orderly admonished the old man strictly.
2 minutes won't be enough,
Homer sighed.
I warned you,
the other man said with a shrug. Even 5 minutes wasn't enough. He didn't have any real idea of where to start, or how to finish, or what questions to ask and what to ask for, but apart from the commandant of Dobrynin Station, he had no one else to turn to right now. But Andrei Andreevich, a large fat man in a uniform tunic that didn't close across his stomach, was already furious and streaming with sweat, and he didn't listen to the old man for long.
"Don't you understand or what? I've got a force majeure situation here. 8 men have been moved down, and you start talking to me about some epidemic or other? There isn't anything here. That's enough. Stop wasting my time. Either you clear out of here yourself, or..."
Like a sperm whale leaping out of the water, the commandant launched his meaty carcass forward, almost overturning the desk he was sitting at. The duty orderly glanced into the office inquiringly. Homer also got up off the low, hard chair for visitors.
"I'll go. But then, why did you send forces into Serpukhov? What business is that of yours?"
"They say in the station..."
"What do they say? What do they say? You know what? To make sure you don't go spreading panic around here? Pasha, come on, stick him in a cage."
In the twinkling of an eye, Homer was tossed out into the reception area, and the duty orderly dragged the stubbornly resisting old man into a narrow side corridor, alternating reproaches with slaps to his face. Between 2 slaps, Homer's respirator came off. He tried to hold his breath, but immediately received a jab to the solar plexus that set him coughing. The sperm whale surfaced in the doorway of his office, filling the opening completely.
"Let him stay there for now. We'll get to the bottom of this later. And who are you? By appointment?"
he barked at the next visitor. Homer had already turned towards him. Hunter was standing there, stock still with his arms crossed, just 3 steps away from him. He was wearing somebody else's uniform that was tight on him and hiding his face in the shadow of the raised visor of his helmet. He showed no sign of recognizing the old man and no intention of intervening. Homer had expected him to be smeared with blood, like a butcher, but the only crimson spot on the brigadier's clothes was a small stain over his own wound. Hunter shifted his stony gaze to the station commandant and suddenly started moving towards him slowly, as if he intended to walk straight through the fat man into the office. The startled commandant started muttering and backed away, opening up the way through. The guard froze expectantly, with his arms locked round Homer. Hunter squeezed through the door after the retreating fat man and ended the commandant's resistance with a single lion's roar that reduced him to silence. Then he switched to an imperious whisper. Letting go of the old man, the orderly stole across to the door and stepped inside. A moment later, he was swept back out by a torrent of filthy expletives, during which the commandant's voice broke into a squeal.
"And let that provocateur go!"
he shouted at the end, as if he was repeating someone else's order under hypnosis. Bright red as if he had been scalded, the orderly closed the door behind him, stomped back to his post at the entrance, and stuck his nose into a news flyer printed on wrapping paper. When Homer moved determinedly past his desk in the direction of the commandant's office, he just huddled down even lower behind his little newspaper to indicate that what happened from now on had nothing to do with him. Homer glanced triumphantly at the guard covering his shame with the news sheet. At last, he could take a proper look at the phones. The one that was winking all the time had a piece of dirty white plaster stuck to it, on which someone had scrawled a single word with a ballpoint pen. Tula.
"We maintain contact with the order," said the commandant of Dobrynin Station, sweating and cracking his fists, but not daring to raise his eyes to the brigadier. "And no one has warned us about this operation. I can't take this decision on my own." "Then call Central," said Hunter. "You have time to agree things, but not much." "They won't give approval. This will endanger the stability of Hansa. Surely you know that comes before anything else for Hansa? And we've got everything under control." "What damn stability? If measures aren't taken..." "The situation is stable. I don't understand what you find unsatisfactory,"
said Andrei Andreevich, shaking his heavy head obstinately.
"All the exits are covered by guns. A mouse couldn't get through.
Let's wait for everything to resolve itself."
"Nothing will resolve itself,"
Hunter bellowed.
"If you wait, all that will happen is that someone will get out and run across the surface or find a roundabout route. The station has to be purged, by the book. I don't understand why you haven't done it yourselves yet."
"But there could be people there who are still well. How do you imagine it happening? Do I order my lads to shoot everyone in Tula and incinerate them? What about the sectarian strain? And maybe clean out Serpukhov at the same time? Half the men here have kept women there and illegitimate children. No, let me tell you something. We're not fascists here. War's war, but this...
killing sick people. Even when there was swine fever at Belorussia, they took the pigs into different corners one at a time so that if one was infected, it died, and if it was healthy, it could live, instead of just slaughtering them all indiscriminately.
Those were pigs. These are people,
the brigadier said flatly.
No, no,
said the commandant, and started shaking his head again, splashing sweat about.
I can't do that. It would be on my conscience afterwards, and I don't want the dreams that would come afterwards.
You won't have to do it yourself. For that there are men who don't have dreams. All you'll do is let us pass through your station. Nothing more.
I sent couriers to Polis to find out about a vaccine,
said Andrei Andreevich, wiping away his perspiration with his sleeve.
There is hope that...
There is no vaccine. There is no hope. Stop burying your head in the sand. Why don't I see any medical units from Central here? Why do you refuse to call them and ask for the green light to let a cohort of the Order through?
The commandant remained obstinately silent. For some reason he tried to fasten the buttons on his tunic, fumbling at them with his slippery fingers and then giving up. He walked over to a shabby sideboard, splashed out a glass of some smelly alcoholic infusion for himself, and downed it in one.
Why, you haven't informed them,
Hunter guessed.
They still don't know anything about it. You've got an epidemic at the next station, and they don't know anything.
I answer for something like that with my head,
the commandant said hoarsely.
An epidemic in the adjacent station means compulsory retirement. I allowed it to happen, didn't prevent it, created a threat to the stability of Hansa.
In the adjacent station, at Serpukhov.
Everything's calm there for the time being. But I caught on too late. Didn't react in time. How could I know?
And how did you explain all this to everyone? The forces at an independent station? The cordoning off of the tunnels?
Bandits? Rebels? It happens everywhere, it's nothing special.
And now it's too late to confess,
the brigadier said with a nod.
It's not retirement now.
Andrei Andreevich poured himself a second glass and downed it.
It's the death penalty.
And now what?
I'm waiting.
The commandant lowered his backside onto his desk.
I'm waiting. What if... Why don't you answer their calls?
Homer put in.
Your phone's blowing its top. They're calling from Tula. What if...
It's not blowing its top,
the commandant replied in a flat, hollow voice.
I turned the sound off. It's just the light blinking. While it still does that, they're alive.
Why don't you answer it?
The old man repeated angrily.
What can I tell them? To hang on and be patient? To get well soon, that help is near, to put a bullet through their heads? Talking to the refugees was as much as I could take!
The commandant yelled, losing control.
Shut up. Immediately.
Hunter told him in a quiet voice.
And listen. I'll come back in one day with the squadron. I have to be allowed through all the guard posts without hindrance. You will keep Serpukhov station closed off. We'll move on to Tula and purge it. If necessary, we'll purge Serpukhov too. We'll pretend it's a small war. You don't have to inform Central. You won't have to do anything at all. I'll do it. I'll restore stability.
The exhausted commandant nodded feebly, as limp as a deflated inner tube from a bicycle tire. He poured out some more infusion for himself, sniffed at it, and before he drank it, asked quietly,
But you'll be up to your elbows in blood. Doesn't that bother you?
Blood's easy to wash off with cold water,
the brigadier told him. As they were walking out of the office, Andrei Andreevich filled his lungs with air and summoned the duty orderly in a stentorian voice. The orderly dashed inside and the door slammed shut behind him with a crash. Dropping back a little from Hunter, the old man leaned across the counter, grabbed the black receiver off the phone he'd been watching, and pressed it to his ear.
Hello? Hello, I'm listening!
He exclaimed in a loud whisper into the sieve of the mouthpiece. Silence. Not blank silence as if the line had been cut. It was a silence that hummed, as if the phone was off the hook at the other end, but there was no one to answer Homer. As if someone there had been waiting for him to answer for a very long time, but hadn't been able to wait any longer. As if now the other receiver was croaking into the ear of a dead man in the old man's distorted voice. Hunter glanced ominously at Homer from the doorway, and the old man carefully put the phone back down and meekly followed the brigadier out.
Pop off, rise and shine, get up quick!
The powerful beam of the commander's flashlight pierced straight through his eyelids, flooding his brain with fire. A strong hand shook him by the shoulder, and then the back of it smashed into Artyom's unshaven cheek.
Where's your gun? Take your automatic and follow me, on the double.
Of course, they dozed with their trousers on, in full gear, in fact, unwinding the tattered rags in which the Kalashnikov that served as his pillow had been wrapped for the night, Artyom tramped off, still swaying after his commander. How long had he managed to sleep? An hour? Two? His head was buzzing and his throat was dry.
It's starting,
said the commander, looking back over his shoulder and breathing stale alcohol fumes into Artyom's face.
What's starting?
He asked in fright.
You'll see in a moment. Here, take this clip. You'll need it.
Tula, a spacious station with no columns, which looked like merely the top of a single unbelievably broad tunnel, was enveloped in almost total darkness. In a few places, feeble beams of light were darting about, but there was no order or system to their movements, no sense at all, as if the flashlights were in the hands of little children or monkeys. Only where would monkeys come from here? Walking instantly and feverishly, checking his automatic, Artyom suddenly realized what had happened. They hadn't been able to hold them. Or maybe it still wasn't too late. Another two soldiers, still puffy and hoarse from sleep, darted out of the watch office and joined them. Along the way, the commander scraped together the remainder, everyone who could still stand on his feet and hold a gun, even the ones who were already coughing a bit. A strange, sinister cry pervaded the thick, stale, expired air, not a scream, not a howl, not a command, a groan pouring out of hundreds of throats, straining in agony, full of despair and horror, a groan punctuated by a meager jangling and scraping of iron that came from 2, 3, 10 places at the same time. The platform was cluttered with torn, sagging tents and capsized kennels for living in, constructed out of sheets of metal and pieces of metro carriage cladding, all jumbled together with plywood counters and people's abandoned belongings. The commander strode on, parting the heaps of garbage like an icebreaker moving through ice packs, with Artyom and the other two trotting along in his wake. A truncated train standing on the right-hand track loomed up out of the darkness. The light in both carriages was off, the open doors had been clumsily blocked with pieces of mobile barriers, and inside, on the other side of the dark window panes, a terrible mishmash of humanity was heaving about, seething and simmering. Dozens of hands had grabbed the bars of the frail barriers and were swaying, shaking and rattling them. Occasionally, the machine gunners in gas masks who were posted at each of the exits skipped up to the black, gaping mouths of the doors and raised their gun butts. But they didn't dare to beat the prisoners, let alone shoot them. In other places, on the contrary, the sentries tried to reason with the raging human sea squeezed into the metal boxes and calm it down. But did the people in the carriages still understand anything? They'd been herded into the train because they started running away from the special sections of the tunnels and because there were already too many of them, more than the healthy men. The commander rushed past the first carriage and the second, and then Artyom saw where they were going in such a great hurry. The last door. That was where the abscess had ruptured. Strange creatures had flooded out of the carriage, barely able to stand, mutilated beyond recognition by the swellings on their faces, with puffy, appallingly thick arms and legs. No one had managed to get away yet. All the free submachine gunners were converging on the door. The commander tore through the cordon and walked forward.
"I order all patients to return to their places immediately,"
he exclaimed, pulling his officer's Stechkin pistol out of its holster. The infected man closest to him raised his cumbersome, swollen head with a struggle, in several stages, and licked his cracked lips.
"Why are you treating us like this?"
"You are aware that you are infected with an unknown virus. We are looking for a cure. You just have to wait for it."
"Looking for a cure,"
the man repeated after him.
"Oh, that's funny."
"Get back into the carriage immediately."
The commander clicked off the safety catch of his revolver.
"I'll count to 10, then I'll shoot to kill. 1.
"You just don't want to leave us without hope, so that you can control us, until we all die anyway.
2.
"It's a day now since they gave us any water. Why give dead men anything to drink?
The sentries are afraid to approach the bars. Two of them have been infected like that. Three?
There are lots of bodies in the carriages already. We are trampling on people's faces. Do you know how a nose crunches? If it's a child's, then...
There's nowhere to put them. We can't burn them. Four.
The next carriage is so cramped, the dead are still standing beside the living, shoulder to shoulder.
Five.
For God's sake, suit me, will you? I know there isn't any cure. I'm going to die soon. Then I won't feel my insides being scraped raw with coarse sandpaper and soaked in alcohol.
Six.
And set alight. It feels like my head's full of worms that are eating away my brain and my soul bit by bit from the inside. Yum, yum, crunch, crunch, crunch.
Seven.
You idiot. Let us out of here. Let us die like human beings. What makes you think you have the right to torture us like this? You know that you're probably already...
Eight. This is all a safety measure so that others can survive. I'm prepared to croak, but not one of you plague dogs is going to leave here. Get ready.
Artyom flung up his automatic and set the sight on the nearest sick person. Oh, God, he thought it was a woman. Swollen breasts stuck out under the T-shirt that was dried into a reddish-brown crust. He blinked and turned his gun barrel towards a shambling old man. The crowd of monsters started muttering and pulled back at first, trying to squeeze back in through the door, but it couldn't. More and more infected people were oozing out of the carriage like fresh pus, groaning and weeping.
You sadist! What are you doing?
You're going to shoot living people!
We're not zombies!
Nine!
The commander's voice turned dull and hollow.
Just let us go!
The sick man yelled hoarsely, reaching his arms out towards the commander, as if he were conducting a choir, and the whole crowd surged forward, following the sweep of his fingers.
Fire!
People started flowing towards Leonid immediately, the moment he put his lips to his instrument. The first sounds drawn out of the barrel of his flute were tentative and impure, but still enough to set the people gathered around smiling and clapping in approval. And when the flute's voice grew firmer, the faces of his listeners were transformed, as if the dirt had fallen away from them. This time, Sasha was awarded a place of distinction beside the musician. Now Leonid was not the only one with dozens of eyes gazing at him intently. Some of the admiring stares came her way. At first, this made the girl feel awkward. After all, she didn't deserve their attention and gratitude. But then the melody picked her up off the granite floor and carried her along with it, distracting her from her surroundings, in the same way that a good book or a story told by someone can captivate you and make you forget about everything. The same melody floated through the air again, Leonid's own composition untitled. He started and ended every one of his performances with it. It could smooth out wrinkles and whisk the dust off the window panes of glazed eyes, lighting little icon lamps on the other side of them. Sasha already knew the melody, but Leonid opened up new mysterious little doors in it, discovering new harmonies, and the music sounded new and different. As if she had been gazing at the sky for a long, long time, and suddenly, through an opening in the white clouds, she had glimpsed a boundless, bottomless, delicate green expanse. Suddenly she felt a prick that startled her and brought her back down under the ground ahead of schedule. Sasha spun round in fright. So that was it. Towering above the crowd, Hunter was standing slightly behind the other listeners with his head thrown back. The sharp, barbed blade of his gaze was thrust into her, and if he released his grip briefly, it was only in order to stab the musician too. Leonid took no notice of the man with the shaved head, or at least he gave no sign that anything was interfering with his playing. Strangely enough, Hunter didn't leave, and he didn't make any attempt to take her away or break off the performance. He waited until the final notes, then moved back and disappeared. Abandoning Leonid, Sasha immediately forced her way into the crowd, trying to keep up with the man with the shaved head. He stopped not far away, in front of a bench on which Homer was sitting looking dejected.
"You heard everything,"
he said in a husky voice.
"I'm leaving. Will you go with me?"
"Where to?"
asked the old man, smiling as the girl walked up to them.
"She knows everything,"
he explained to the man with the shaved head. Hunter stabbed Sasha again with his barbed gaze. then nodded without saying anything to her.
Not far, he said, shifting his head to speak to the old man. But I don't want to be left alone.
Take me with you,
said Sasha, seizing her chance. The man with the shaved head breathed in loudly, clenching his fingers and unclenching them again.
Thank you for the knife, he said eventually. It came in very useful.
The girl recoiled, stung, but gathered her courage again immediately.
You decide what to do with the knife,
she objected.
I had no choice.
But now you do.
She bit on her lower lip and frowned.
No, I still don't. If you know, then you must understand. If you really...
Understand what?
How important it is to get to Tula. How important it is for me. As quickly as possible.
Sasha saw his fingers trembling, and a dark patch spreading across his shoulder. She was beginning to feel afraid of this man, and even more afraid for him.
You have to stop,
she told him gently.
Out of the question, he snapped. It's not important who does it, so why not me?
Because you'll destroy yourself.
The girl touched his hand tentatively, and he started, as if he had been stung.
I have to. Cowards decide everything here as it is. If I delay any longer, I'll destroy the whole metro.
But what if there was another way? If there was a cure? If you didn't have to do it any longer?
How many times do I have to say it? There aren't any cures for this fever. Do you really think that I would... that I would...
What would you choose?
Asked Sasha, not letting go of him.
There's nothing to choose from,
the man with the shaved head exclaimed, shaking off her hand.
We're leaving, he barked to the old man.
Why don't you want to take me with you?
She protested.
I'm afraid.
He said it in a very low voice, almost a whisper, so that no one but Sasha could hear him. He swung round and strode away, growling curtly to the old man that he had 10 minutes before they set out.
Am I mistaken, or is someone here a bit feverish?
Said a voice behind Sasha's back.
What?
She spun round and collided with Leonid.
I thought I heard you talking about a fever, he said with an innocent smile.
You misheard.
She didn't intend to discuss anything with him right now.
And I thought the rumors had been confirmed after all,
the musician said thoughtfully as if he were talking to himself.
What rumors?
Asked Sasha, frowning.
About the quarantine at Serpukhov, about some supposedly incurable disease, about an epidemic.
He watched her intently, seizing on every movement of her lips and her eyebrows.
So how long were you eavesdropping?
She asked, blushing bright red.
I never do it deliberately, it's just my musical hearing.
He shrugged and spread his hands.
He's my friend,
she explained for some reason, nodding in the direction Hunter had gone in.
A classy kind of friend, he replied enigmatically.
Why do you say supposedly incurable?
Sasha!
Homer got up off the bench, keeping a suspicious eye fixed on the musician.
Can I have a word? We need to discuss what to do from here on.
Will you let me have just a second?
Said Leonid. Dismissing the old man with a polite smile, he skipped aside and beckoned for the girl to follow him. Sasha stepped towards him uncertainly. She still had the feeling that the battle with Hunter wasn't lost yet, that if she didn't give up now, Hunter wouldn't have the heart to drive her away again, that she could still help him, even though she didn't have the slightest idea of how to do it.
Maybe I heard about the epidemic much sooner than you did,
Leonid whispered to her.
Maybe this isn't the first outbreak of the disease. And what if there are some magical tablets that can cure it?
Asked the musician, glancing into her eyes.
But he says that there is no cure, that they'll all have to be...
Sasha babbled.
Liquidated,
said Leonid, finishing her sentence for her.
He... Is that your wonderful friend? Well, that wouldn't surprise me, but what I'm saying is the opinion of a qualified doctor.
You mean to say...
I mean to say,
said the musician, putting his hand on Sasha's shoulder, leaning down to her and breathing gently into her ear,
that the illness can be treated.
There is a cure.
Chapter 15. By twos.
The old man first cleared his throat irritably, then took a long step towards them.
Sasha, I need to have a talk with you.
Leonid winked at the girl and moved away from her a little, relinquishing her to Homer with theatrical submission. But she couldn't think about anything else any longer, and while the old man explained something to her, trying to convince her that Hunter could still be talked round, suggesting and cajoling, the girl looked over his shoulder at the musician. He didn't return her glance, but the faint ironic smile hovering on his lips told Sasha that he saw everything and understood everything. She nodded to Homer, ready to agree with everything he said, just as long as she could be alone with the musician for another minute, and hear him finish what he was saying, just as long as she herself could believe that there was a cure.
"I'll be back in a moment," she said, running out of patience and interrupting the old man in mid-word.
She slipped off and ran over to Leonid.
"Back for a second helping?"
he said, welcoming her back.
"You must tell me," she said, no longer willing to play games with him. "How?"
"That's a bit more complicated. I know the disease is curable. I know people who have beaten it. I can take you to them."
"But you said you knew how to fight it."
"You misinterpreted what I said," he said with a shrug. "How would I know? I'm just a flute player, a wandering musician."
"Who are these people?"
"If you're interested, I can introduce you to them. We'll have to walk a bit, though."
"Which station are they at?"
"Not very far from here. You can find out everything, if you want to."
"I don't trust you."
"But you want to trust me, don't you?" he remarked. "I don't trust you yet, either. That's why I can't tell you everything."
"Why do you want me to go with you?"
asked Sasha, narrowing her eyes.
"Me?"
he shook his head.
"It's all the same to me. It's you who wants to go. I don't have to save anyone. And I don't know how to save them, at least not like that." "Do you promise you'll take me to these people? Do you promise they'll be able to help?"
she asked, after hesitating for a brief moment.
"I'll take you," Leonid replied firmly.
"What have you decided?"
the old man asked insistently, interrupting them again.
"I'm not going with you,"
said Sasha, plucking at the strap of her overalls.
"He says there's a cure for the fever," she added, turning towards the musician.
"He's lying,"
Homer said uncertainly.
"I see you know a lot more about viruses than I do,"
Leonid said respectfully.
"Have you studied them? Or is it from personal experience? Do you also believe that exterminating everybody is the best way of combating the infection?"
"How do you—"
the old man began dumbfounded.
"Did you tell him?"
he asked, looking around at Sasha.
"Here comes your highly qualified friend," said the musician, prudently taking a step back as he spotted Hunter approaching. "Well then, the ambulance brigade is all here. I'm beginning to feel superfluous."
"He's lying. He just wants to get you to... But even if it's true,"
Homer whispered fervently to her,
"you won't have time to do anything. Hunter will be back here with reinforcements in a day's time at the latest. If you stay with us, perhaps you'll be able to persuade him. But this boy..."
"I won't be able to do anything,"
Sasha responded gloomily.
"Nobody's going to stop him now. I can sense it. He has to be given a choice. To split him..."
"Split him?"
Homer's eyebrows shot up.
"I'll be back here in less than a day,"
she promised, stepping away.
Why did he let her go? Why did he weaken and allow a crazy tramp to abduct his heroine, his muse, his daughter? The more closely the old man studied Leonid, the less he liked him. His big green eyes could suddenly cast surprisingly covetous glances, and obscure shadows skimmed across that angelic face when the young man thought no one was watching him. What did she want with the musician? At best, that connoisseur of the beautiful would stick a pin through the flower of her innocence, and leave it to dry in his memory, crumpled up with all the charm of youth, which was so impossible to remember or even photograph, lost, scattered like pollen. Deceived and exploited, the girl would take flight, but it would be a long time before she could purge herself and forget, especially since this blasted wandering minstrel wanted to win her by deception. Then why did he let her go? Out of cowardice. Because Homer was not just afraid of arguing with Hunter, he was even afraid of asking him the questions that were really worrying him. Because Sasha was in love, and her audacity and folly could be forgiven. Would the brigadier have shown him the same indulgence? To himself, the old man still called him the brigadier, partly out of habit, but partly because it made Homer feel calmer. There was nothing terrible happening, nothing unusual. He was still the same brigadier of the Northern Watch from Sebastopol. But he wasn't.
The man striding shoulder to shoulder with Homer now was not the same old unsociable soldier of fortune. The old man was beginning to understand. His traveling companion was being transformed before his very eyes. Something terrible was happening to him, and it would have been stupid to deny it. It was pointless trying to persuade himself. Hunter had taken Homer with him again. This time was it to show him the bloody denouement of the whole drama? Now he was prepared to exterminate not only the whole of Tula, but also the sectarians cooped up in the tunnels and Serpukhov Station too, including all its inhabitants and the soldiers sent there from the Hansa garrison, simply on the suspicion that one of them might have become infected. The same fate could be in store for Sebastopol. He no longer needed reasons for killing, he was just looking for pretexts. Homer could only summon up enough strength to trudge after Hunter as if he was mesmerized, contemplating and documenting all the brigadier's crimes like some nightmarish dream, justifying himself by the fact that they were committed in order to save people, trying to convince himself that this was the lesser of two evils. To Homer, the relentless brigadier seemed like an incarnation of Moloch, and he had never tried to get the better of fate. But Sasha didn't seem to acknowledge fate at all. And if, in the depths of his heart, the old man had already accepted that Tula and Serpukhov would be turned into Sodom and Gomorrah, the girl was still clutching at the tiniest hope. Homer had stopped trying to convince himself that any pills or vaccine or serum would turn up before Hunter stopped the epidemic with fire and lead. Sasha was prepared to keep searching for the cure right to the end. Homer wasn't a soldier or a doctor, and above all, he was too old to believe in miracles. But there was still a particle of his soul that passionately desired miracles and dreamed of salvation. He had torn that particle out of himself and let it go with Sasha. He had simply offloaded onto the girl what he wouldn't have dared to do himself. And in his resignation, he had discovered peace for himself. In 24 hours, it would all be over. And after that, the old man would desert from his post, find himself a monastic cell, and finish writing his book. Now he knew what it would be about. About how a nimble-witted beast found a magical fallen star, a heavenly spark, swallowed it and became a man. About how, after stealing fire from the gods, man hadn't been able to control it, and had burnt the world to a cinder. About how, as a punishment, exactly 100 centuries later, that human spark was taken away from him. But after losing it, he didn't become a beast again. He turned into something far more terrible, that didn't even have a name. The head of the sentry squad tipped the handful of cartridges into his pocket and sealed his deal with the musician with a firm handshake.
"For a symbolic additional payment, I could put you on a tram," he said.
"I prefer romantic walks," Leonid replied.
"Well, look at it this way. I can't let the two of you walk through our tunnels on your own," said the sentry, trying to reason with him. "You'll have to go with a guard anyway. Your girl hasn't got any documents. And you could get to where you're going express in a flash, and there you are, all alone with her," he whispered loudly.
"We don't need to be all alone,"
Sasha declared adamantly.
"We'll consider it a guard of honor, as if we're the prince and princess of Monaco out promenading," said the musician, bowing to the girl. "What princess?"
Sasha asked, overcome by curiosity.
"The Princess of Monaco. There was a principality of that name once, right on the Côte d'Azur, the Azure coast."
"Listen," the sentry interrupted, "if you want to walk, come on, get ready, will you? A cartridge clip's all very fine, but the lads have got to get back to base before evening.
Hey, Kostya," he called to a soldier, "see these two to Kiev. Tell the patrols it's a deportation. Put them out onto the radial station and get straight back. All correct?"
he asked, turning to Leonid.
"Yes, sir,"
said Leonid with a humorous salute.
"Come again,"
said the sentry, giving him a wink. How incredibly different Hansa territory really was from all the rest of the metro. All the way along the stretch of tunnel from Pavelets to Oktober, Sasha hadn't seen a single place that was completely dark. Every 50 steps, there were light bulbs hanging from the wire that crept along the wall, and every one of them gave enough light to reach the next one. Even the reserve and secret tunnels branching off from the main line were well lit, and there was nothing frightening about them any longer. If it had been up to Sasha, she would have gone dashing on ahead, done anything to save the precious minutes, but Leonid persuaded her there was no need to hurry. He flatly refused to say where they would go on to after Kiev Station,
and strolled along at a leisurely pace with a bored air. She supposed the musician had quite often been in stretches of the tunnels that were barred to ordinary inhabitants of the metro.
"I'm glad that your friend has his own approach to everything," he said.
"What do you mean by that?"
Sasha asked with a frown.
"If he dreamed as strongly as you do of saving the civilian population, we would have had to take him with us. But this way, we've split up into pairs and everyone gets to do what he wants to do. He gets to kill, you get to cure."
"He doesn't want to kill anyone,"
she said in a shrill voice that was much too loud.
"Oh, right. It's just his job, that's all," he sighed. "And who am I to judge him?"
"And what are you going to do?"
asked Sasha, not attempting to conceal her scorn.
"Play your flute?"
"I'm just going to be with you,"
Leonid said with a smile.
"What else do I need for happiness?"
"You're just saying that,"
said Sasha, shaking her head.
"You don't even know me at all. How can I make you happy?"
"There are ways. Just to look at a beautiful girl is enough to improve my mood. And then..."
"Do you think you know about beauty?"
she asked, squinting sideways at him.
"It's the only thing I do know anything about,"
he said with a solemn nod.
"So what's so special about me?"
she asked, and the wrinkles on her forehead smoothed out at last.
"It's the way you just glow."
His voice sounded serious, but an instant later the musician dropped back a step and ran his eyes over her.
"It's just a pity you like such crude clothes,"
he added, also dropping back in order to detach his ticklish gaze from her back.
"They don't let the light through, and I'm like a moth. I always fly towards the flame,"
he said, fluttering his hands with a deliberately foolish air.
"Are you afraid of the dark?"
she asked, accepting the game.
"Loneliness?"
Leonard put on a mask of sadness and folded his arms. That was his mistake. As he tuned the strings, he misjudged the resistance, and the finest one, the most delicate, which might have started to sing in just another moment, twanged and snapped. The light tunnel draft, which had blown away Sasha's serious thoughts and made her juggle with the musician's playful hints, instantly died away. She sobered up and rebuked herself for giving way to him. Surely it wasn't for this that she had abandoned Hunter and left the old man behind.
"As if you even knew what that is,"
Sasha snapped and turned away.